afternoon to everyone. My name is Adam Ilkwitz. I cover Canadian communications for Citigroup. And for those in the room, there are disclosures at the registration desk if you'd like to see them. We are pleased to be joined by BCE and CFO Glen LeBlanc, as well as Rich Benjamin from Investor Relations. So welcome and thank you for coming.
Thank you for having us, Adam. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so Glen, just wanted to start off with thinking about as we enter a new year, obviously guidance is coming in a couple of weeks, but what are your key operating and strategic priorities as you exit 2018 and plan for 2019?
Sure. Well, I think, Adam, as you know all too well, it's a lot more of the same as our strategy, and something we pride ourselves on is steady at the helm. Heavy investment in fiber has been a strategy of ours. At the end of 2018, we will have completed 4.5 million homes of fiber. Realistically, it ultimately it probably reaches 9 of our 12 million homes and businesses, so we're past the halfway mark. We completed our largest urban center in Toronto. I would say we're virtually done at more than a million locations completed in calendar 18. So continuing that investment in fiber, continuing to make the necessary investments in our wireless network to our wireless network leadership position and maintaining that. I think a big breakthrough for us in the last year, we talked quite a bit about it, is the opportunity that we now see in kind of the suburban, rural areas for wireless to the prem. We think ultimately in the next 3 years is another 800,000 homes, maybe as many as a million that we can pass with that technology. So when we think about the 12 million homes and businesses that we serve, and we think about the next 5 to 7 years, if you complete 9 million of those with fiber to the home, we roll out our wireless home, which currently we're doing on our LTE network, but obviously you would see the ability to deliver fixed wireless over 5G in time. And then that leaves you with a million and a half to 2 million homes that maybe ultimately 5G will play a role in broadband delivery, 5G wireless. So the strategy for us has been one of a consistent execution of driving the network deeper and deeper. And frankly, rebuilding that 130-year-old copper network. So, you know, a lot more of the same, and that is execution.
Sure. So let's start looking at how the business has evolved over the course of 2018 and thinking about the end of the year. The wireless market was very competitive in 2017, especially in that fun weekend, which you were a beneficiary of. But it seems like the competitive landscape has migrated away from price a little bit for the main brands towards extra data or devices. How are you measuring that as a total market?
Yeah, I'd say that's a fair observation, Adam. I think what we've seen is aggressive promotional pricing on those key event-driven, you know, calendar events. Back to school is one, Black Friday tends to be another, and then, of course, into your Christmas and your Boxing Day time. And what we've seen occur is very much what you've witnessed in the U.S., and that is that the pricing was the early competitive challenge was that on price. And in 2017, it's been a couple of years now, we watched a shift where it was quite promotional on large data buckets. And if you remember what occurred in Black Friday in 2017, there was a special in Canada, 10 gigs for $60, and we've seen all kinds of activity transpire. We were a big winner of that in Q4 of 17. And although that didn't repeat itself specifically in calendar 18, we did start to see large data bonuses. Back to school, there were, you know, doubling up on your data, get 8 gigs for the price of 4. And then that continued into Black Friday, and then into Boxing Day. We've seen it repeat itself. We also seen, I think it was referred to as the data binge plan. Big binge data was launched by one of our competitors, which was a similar offering, promotional offering, that you received 100 gigs of data that you could utilize at any time over the life of your plan. Well, if the average plan length is 24 months, then
then frankly, that's approximately 4 gigs of extra data per month. So it was packaged creatively, but it felt a lot like the doubling of your 4 to 8. I think most of, you know, the flanker brands matched, some of the flanker brands matched that large binge data plan. We did not. But all in all, I think the landscape continued to be competitive throughout 18, promotional-based throughout those calendar event times. But we were very pleased with the share that we were able to take, our net adds that we reported through the end of Q3 were very, very strong. I won't speak to Q4 yet. We'll be doing that in February. So all in all, I think a healthy market remains in Canada, despite the introduction of a fourth player. We lag the U.S. in penetration. So I still think there's opportunity there at around 87%. We have quite a lag. And with immigration driving population growth of approximately 400,000 a year, I think the opportunity still is there for the fourth players to enjoy good net add growth each, despite the fact that the fourth player is taking some share early.
Right. And we're free to take questions from the audience. If anyone has any, you know, please raise your hand and we'll move to you. But continuing along the wireless theme, it's been about a year since that fourth competitor relaunched with their aggressive data bucket offers. Has that normalized in the market, and how have you seen consumer perception change towards that fourth player versus Bell, versus Virgin, your flanker brand, and then the introduction of Lucky as your low-cost data provider? How has the consumer perception of the industry changed maybe in the past 12 months?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head that the industry is evolving. All of the incumbents now have multiple brands that is serving Canadians across a much broader price point, as I think is how it's evolved. The launch of Lucky was very strategic for us, and it's gone extremely well. One of our largest competitors in Canada did a phenomenal job in the prepaid space. And with a lot of new Canadians coming in and maybe not having the background or the credit background to get a postpaid subscription, they were able to move into prepaid, and our competitor did a good job of pre to post migration, develop a relationship with the customer and then migrate them onto a postpaid plan and maybe a customer for life. It's a space we weren't playing in, and launched Lucky, you know, I think a year, 18 months ago now, and very pleased with how that's allowing us to enjoy that pre-to-post migration experience as well. All of the incumbents now have multiple brands, from a prepaid brand to a flanker brand and to our core brands. Yes, Freedom is relatively new in the space and tend to use promotion, and we're playing on the low end of price. I think we were able to lay on top quite successfully with our prepaids and our flanker brands to protect pricing on the higher end. And you have to remember that there's not network equivalency between Freedom and ourselves. And I think we find ourselves in a position of having, you know, a better network experience, a broader handset lineup, certainly a broader distribution lineup than they would have, with phenomenal distribution in stores across the country for ourselves. And on any given quarter, on any given promotion, we certainly can turn up the heat. We also own the largest suite of media assets in the country, so we can yell from the rooftops. So although there's certainly been share take, and we've noticed the manner in which they do it, it would be that early on would be price, early on would be large bucket promotions. But I think we've managed it well. I think the industry has managed it well. The growth is there for the industry. And frankly, when I fast forward to tomorrow, heavy investment is going to be required to bring their network up to network equivalency. There's 600 spectrum, there's 3.5, there's millimeter wave. These are all going to be, you know, costly. And frankly, you can't live off $50 and $55 ARPUs and get a return for your shareholders. So I think price discipline will be required in the future for sure.
How do you respond to what's probably a U.S.-based investor viewpoint, but broadly, that the fourth player in the U.S. revitalize their brand with inferior network, with inferior distribution, and your competitor loved the idea so much they put one of them on their board who helped architect that strategy. How is Canada going to deal with that potential, fourth entrant, potentially having these disadvantages but taking share anyway? How is it different from the U.S. experience?
It's very different from the U.S. experience. The Canadian landscape is wireless, or is wireline cable telcos that all have a wireless asset. And we don't have that disruptor that is going to come in and scorch earth. These are long-established companies with established physical footprints and landline footprints that have balance sheets they need to protect, a dividend that they need to pay, and a shareholder expectation that's been in place for decades and decades and decades. That is a very different landscape than a disruptor who's prepared to take leverage in different directions. I just don't think it's the same. If a Freedom Shaw got into the business, naturally they recognize convergence, the need to be involved if you're going to be a successful wireline and internet broadband provider, the requirement to have wireless as a complement to that. They've been very successful operators for decades, and I suspect they will be again. But they also have to protect their underlying wireline base, and they're not going to go out and scorch earth. They're looking to bundle. They're looking to win the whole home. They're looking to win the consumer. And I think it's a very different landscape if you look at who the wireless players are in Canada.
The wireline landscape in Canada is also pretty different from the U.S. in the amount of fiber investment that you've been doing. Looking at the share you have in markets that have been converted to fiber, it seems like across your footprint, you're gaining share amongst consumer broadband. How do you see that playing out? And the promotions in that market have been fierce, and it's been hand-to-hand and building by building in some cases.
Yes.
How do you see that playing out as the offering becomes citywide as it has in Toronto?
Well, it's no secret that in many of our large urban markets, over a decade ago, we lost the predominant internet share to the cable competitor. And, there were times through this last decade that there's technology leapfrogging. But one thing that I can say with certainty is that nothing leapfrogs fiber. And the decision was made by us to go with an aggressive fiber-to-the-home strategy, a fiber-to-the-home deployment, and deliver a technology that, quite frankly, is future-proof. The ability to deliver 1 gig, and we now have 1.5 gig in market, and ultimately 5 and 10 gig services, allowed us to once again be competitive. If you went back over a decade ago, we had a competitive product, but DSL started to lag coax, and then investments needed to be made in fiber to the node to stay competitive. But ultimately, we're now with a network technology that is frankly superior. So when I look at the markets we're rolling fiber out, what's happening is we're taking back share. We're taking back share that we've lost over a decade. And frankly, in a two-player market, tell me why I wouldn't get to 50% market share again. I could argue with network superiority I should get north of that. But if you at least take it back to 50% share, you'd think that in our urban markets we have 37-38% market share. There is a sizable opportunity that fiber is providing us to take internet share, which of course has legacy voice pull through and of course video pull through. And it's working. Everywhere we've deployed fiber, we're taking back share.
Is there any statistics or things you can share, whether it be the original Bell Alliance builds and how you've rebuilt market share over an extended period of time, just to not do it on an 18 or 12-month basis?
Yeah, well, I look back to markets where we rolled out fiber in Atlantic Canada, and in those days, we had no video share, none whatsoever, no TV share, and we have markets now that we're north of 50, we're actually north of 60, that we are the incumbent internet and TV provider in parts of Atlantic Canada, starting from a position of zero. And I mean, that is impressive. I guess it's pushing 9 years, I guess, now, Adam, and maybe even 10, then when we launch some of our first cities in Atlantic Canada. But it's impressive. And I continue to go back that in a two-player market, I see opportunity to take share.
Sure. Sticking on the consumer side with video, the evolution is dramatic, and you've gone a little bit more aggressive with the Alt TV package, and especially in the condo market. But you're obviously developing the IPTV further.
Sure.
You're also the largest media owner in Canada, so you've got a dog in both sides of the fight. How do you see that market evolving, and does Bell need to take a leadership position in the way that's evolving to make sure that the overall pie of profits is being split in a way that's
good? I think we have to take a leadership role. We're the largest TV provider in Canada and have to show leadership. It's no surprise to anyone that cord cutting and cord shaving is real, and it's not going anywhere. So the launch of All TV is all about recognizing that. It's all about recognizing that there is a segment of consumers that you are no longer capturing with linear or traditional video delivery, and they want a different product. And All TV is a different product. It's an over-the-top TV service that's delivered on a maximum of two streams, and you have to have our internet service to enjoy that product. But it is a recognition that we have to dip our toe into that water. We have to understand that consumer behavior, that a consumer's needs, because that is a growing market. I mean, what we could have a debate here on whether there'll ever be a set-top box in the home one day. I mean, there's all kinds of folks that think we can debate the time horizon, whether it's 2025 or 2028, or maybe it's later than that, or maybe it's earlier. But frankly, it seems reasonable to assume that there will be no set-top box, and this will be the manner in which entertainment is delivered onto any screen in any place, at any time. And I think Alt TV, we're the first in Canada to deliver such a service of that magnitude, and our largest cable competitor is behind and has not launched anything yet on that. And I think we're taking tremendous learnings from that right now, and we're protecting the ecosystem, we're learning, we're trying to be an aggregator, because one thing hasn't changed. Consumers are buying and consuming more content than ever. It's not that they're not looking for content. So how do we ensure that we have a platform simplification of aggregation? So that if you can buy Alt TV and included in that is HBO, and included in that is Showtime, and included in that is your local Canadian news, and we can put maybe Netflix within that, and you can pay one price, and it's a fair and reasonable offer, then I think it can become compelling. So I would say it was one of our most strategic moves in the last 12 to 24 months, learning from it every day. And that product has to be every bit as robust as the traditional linear set-top box is into the future. And you mentioned that we're investing with Ericsson and Media Room and ultimately Media First, but we're also investing in this platform that I think will be paramount for video delivery. And the fact that we own the largest media company, of course we want to ensure that we're not missing eyeballs. We get paid through advertising by ensuring that eyeballs are captured, and I think Alt TV is capturing eyeballs that we may have otherwise lost.
BC has historically been very prudent with the investments, and you're investing in Crave, an SVOD platform, Alt TV, an Android TV platform, IPTV platform, and Five. Obviously, these go into different customer segments, but I don't think necessarily you want to continue investing in three separate video platforms over time. Is there a convergence amongst these different offers, or do you, over time, see them existing separately?
I wouldn't agree with that statement. I would argue they are one platform. Our Alt TV app is on the exact same platform and that our Five TV platform is on. So the app that you download on your device to control your box at home is is the exact same app that you download for Alt TV. Behind the scenes, these are the same platform. Alt TV is a streaming video platform, but we can integrate that into our RFI platform as well. So I would say we were very, very cognizant in the development, and our IT team is very cognizant of where we're going to ensure fully integrated TV delivery platform is paramount. So I would say that is that's of the forefront of focus.
I'm looking on the enterprise side of the wireline house. You've had a change in tax policy to try to respond to what the U.S. has done to keep enterprises investing up in Canada. How have you seen the enterprise environment changing over the past year, and what's your expectation over the next year?
It's probably been the best 4 to 6 quarter run we've had in the enterprise space in what I will say is the better part of a decade. Very, very pleased. We're the predominant share owner of in the enterprise space. We have the largest market share, but the challenge we face is it's been repriced. Really, it's not been the lack of customers. But I think the introduction of new products that our enterprise team has done, a little healthier economy that we've seen in the past 4 to 6 weeks, the immigration and improvement in job growth has seen that space stabilize for us. And I don't want to overstate it. We're celebrating smaller declines, I guess is the way to put it, on a quarterly basis. That segment still declines because of the drag of our historic legacy products in there. But the new growth products are now starting to take hold, and the health of the economy is starting to allow that business unit to perform on its own, where that, in any given month, maybe the profit is on kind of either side of zero, which is exciting to see when it was in a state of decline for so long. So I think our enterprise space is one of our biggest surprises or most pleasant surprises of calendar 18, and certainly hope that continues into 19. But we're seeing all kinds of signs that the economy is healthy enough to do that. And I know you kind of slipped in another comment there about accelerated capital cost allowance that the changes government made in late 2018. And although not as far as we would have liked to see, and as far as the U.S. went, I don't want to underestimate how important this is for us. It's an opportunity for us to have three times the CCA, or the capital cost allowance accelerated from where the CCA rates are today. And that will, over the next 5 years, be sizable free cash flow opportunity for us. Sizable, right now we're trying to define it, but it's probably more than 100, maybe less than 200 in any given year. But when you're an organization that generates $3.6 billion a year in free cash flow, of which about 2.6 is paid out in the form of dividend, and you're left with about 900 to play with, another $150 million is real. And that allows us, I think, to really focus on our strategy of ensuring that we have a predictable, dependable, reliable dividend increase for our shareholders. It allows us to ensure that we accelerate the investments that have been so important to our business, and that is fiber and the broadband investments. That everywhere we go, I said everywhere we drive, whether it be wireless to home or fiber to home, we take share, and that's good for Canadians, and that's good for our shareholders, and that's good for our customers. It allows us to ensure that we grow the dividend while protecting the balance sheet, not getting outside of our investment grade credit rating leverage parameters. So I think, although it's not been talked about a lot, I think that is very important and really stabilizes an already our core strategy. And I think helps answer the question that we often get from shareholders, and that is, can you maintain the dividend growth model while making the necessary investments in your wireless and fiber networks and respecting your balance sheet over the foreseeable future? And I think this just supported the answer that we've always had, which is yes, we can.
thinking about the financial leverage, as you just mentioned, you have about $1 billion a year to play with after you pay the dividend. Your leverage ratio is still above your target, and we're entering a period where spectrum auctions are coming back. How should investors think about the direction of leverage? Obviously, EBITDA is rising, but how should we think about debt levels and the need to participate in these coming spectrum auctions, and whether the timeline to get to your 1.75 to 2.25 leverage target is still going to be reached in a reasonable amount of time?
Well, I think you have to look at the last 5 to 7 years and say, you know, we went through a time of historic low interest rates and not a time that I was interested in aggressively paying down debt because I thought there were better usage of that free cash flow. Like one, we were very aggressive in trying to eliminate a very sizable pension deficit burden that we had, and we put billions into our pension plan in the last number of years, and happy to report that we sit here today and we're virtually fully funded at 100%. So that's a free cash flow burden of the past decade that I think is behind us when I look out to 2019 and beyond. We were aggressive in M&A, and I think most of the acquisitions we've made, like Bell Alliance and like MTS and our media assets, have proven to be tremendous investments that have offered great cash flow injection and supported our core business. But when I look out to the future, I would say that the same level of M&A activity is highly, highly unlikely. So if you think about how we utilized our excess free cash flow in the past, it's been addressing that pension burden. It's been highly accretive M&A. It's been ensuring that we participated adequately in all spectrum auctions. And when I look out to the future, I'll say without the M&A and without the pension, then I think we can use that excess free cash flow to ensure that we continue a leadership position in spectrum, address our balance sheet responsibly. I don't think there's a rush, but I think we can start to change the trajectory of that leverage back towards our target in a reasonable time frame with the existing cash flow. So I think we're in a heck of a good place.
Sure.
And as you look at your asset base now, you have a tremendous balance sheet, lots of opportunity maybe for non-core assets or things that you've acquired parts of over the years, and maybe they don't make sense inside the footprint anywhere. Are there any non-core assets or other things that could maybe change the asset mix at all?
I don't think so. We're very happy with the asset mix we have. The media assets we have are performing very, very well. I think they're punching outside of their weight class when you look at the industry. And although it only represents 7% of our EBITDA on a pure line of business, I don't think you should lose sight of the fact that being the largest TV provider in the country, we actually buy over a third of our content from ourselves by owning these media assets. We're one of the largest advertisers in the country, and we buy all of our media advertising from ourselves. So I think those assets serve us well. It's been a tremendous amount of cash because they're very low capital intensity. And the assets we've made in our core telephony space have served us very, very well. So we're happy with the assets we have, and I don't think there's a burning desire to move anything material.
I'm curious to know your thoughts on the recent decision by incumbents in Japan to slash mobile rates up to 40% following political pressure, given that Canadian incumbents have some of the highest wireless service margins and ARPUs in the OECD, yet some of the lowest data consumption rates and penetration rates, if you look at nationally. Could this pose a similar regulatory risk, in your opinion?
I certainly don't think. I'll go back to my comments earlier about who the wireless providers are in Canada. Also, you have to recognize that in Canada, the networks we have in Canada are maybe the best wireless networks in the world. South Korea arguably has a better network. And that serves Canadians very, very well. I think our government takes great respect in what we've done to build out the networks we have. We have one of the largest geographical masses in the world, yet only 36 million people live there. Yet when you go to Canada, you would never know by the quality of the networks that have been built in a across the Canadian Shield and across tough geography, across northern geography. Yet the quality of our networks are phenomenal and amongst the best in the world. With that becomes the question of our price is too high, and I think this government, now the Liberal government that we have in Canada today, has shown a desire to work with all of the providers in Canada and ensure that we find the balance. And the balance is, are we able to ensure that we have a broad range of pricing so that all Canadians in different income brackets can afford to take advantage of these incredible networks? And I think we tried to work with government recently. The government made it quite clear that they wanted to ensure that all Canadians had affordable wireless. And the three large incumbents made a proposal to government. And, it was not a forced proposal. It was a desire that they had to ensure that we were delivering affordable pricing to Canadians. We all made a proposal that was recently accepted by government, and that proposal will ensure that cellular service or wireless service as low as $19.99 a month is available to Canadians who may not afford the luxuries of other Canadians, find themselves on some type of federal or social assistance. And if they are on that assistance, that we will make sure that they have access to affordable. That is what I think is the sign of a true open communication and an attempt at partnership with government, to say we can do this together. We can deliver what is required to ensure Canadians are connected, yet ensure that we don't stifle the investment that it's needed to have and continue to have some of the best wireless networks in the world. So I think we're finding a place now. I think the introduction of Lucky is another example. There are multiple brands finding themselves in market. I think it's up to 20 wireless brands now that find themselves in Canada, and I think will serve different needs for different Canadians in different income brackets. Thank you for your question.
Thinking about the relationship with government in general, like you said, a new CRTC commissioner was put in place pretty recently and has been a little bit more amenable to prioritizing investment versus strictly seeking price. But there are a few regulatory agenda items on there, such as looking at the wireless code and looking at different things. What within the regulatory environment do you see as potentially meaningful to the Bell companies?
Well, I think that the biggest message delivered by government is that they are continue to support facilities-based competition in Canada, and that they're not going to mandate MVNO. And I think this commissioner is knowledgeable of industry, a very smart guy that recognizes that if we cut investment, we will suffer with the networks we have. On the other hand, we don't win every decision that we bring in front of them. So there has to be a balance. And I think what I'm most encouraged by is the desire for the commission and this government to work with us to find solutions, much like the solution I just alluded to a moment ago on ensuring affordable wireless services for all Canadians. So when I look out to the decisions that are in front of the commission today, I think I'm comforted by the fact that they're trying to find balance in a partnership. And I don't think any of the incumbents are going to say that every decision has gone our way, and we'll always push and ask for more, and that's our job. But I do believe that this commissioner and this government is very cognizant of the fact that we as Canadians are lucky to have the infrastructure we have, and let's find a balance to not destroy that.
Sure. One question that we get globally is 5G. And thinking about how to deploy 5G services, what type of 5G services, and the time frame. So you guys have been trialing, but maybe you can update us on how you're viewing the 5G opportunity, both as a fiber provider and also as a wireless company.
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and you have to separate it like that, Adam, because 5G wireless and 5G fixed are two very different things. But we believe that we're as well positioned as anyone with 5G fixed because of our wireline infrastructure investment that we've done. I mentioned before we have 4.5 million homes and businesses completed with fiber, and that we ultimately see that reaching 9 million over the next 5 to 7 years. All of the backhaul for 5G requires fiber, and the small cell deployment and bringing cells deeper and deeper into your network all requires backhaul to be on fiber. And the big advantage we have is that all of our network now is fiber. So when I think about our largest competitors, they have a sizable investment in front of them as they look to 5G readiness, and that is it's fibering up backhaul. Where for us, that's what we're doing right now. In many regards, when I think about the 9 or 10 year program of fiber to the home that we've launched, in many regards, I could argue, was our 5G readiness program. And that's, I think, no one is better positioned for us. The ability for us to launch to 800,000 homes a wireless to the prem product on our LTE network was because of how deep fiber is in our network, and that we were able to roll out small cell deployment for that last mile and utilize the fiber backhaul that we had. So I think we're in great shape. But I think it's probably still 3 years out before we see commercial deployment of 5G wireless. I think for the next number of years, we'll advance that small cell deployment on our LTE network, and then ultimately that allows us to deliver broadband speeds, 25 to 50. But when we can convert that onto the 5G fixed wireless, I think that'll be 100 plus. So I think the strategy we're following now is truly one of network convergence, and you're feeling it happen right in front of you, and the fiber backhaul we have is going to set us up to have a great competitive advantage for 5G in the future.
Maybe as our last question, free cash flow, which is one of BCE's hallmarks. Now that you're nearing the halfway point or exceeding the halfway point of your fiber build, your mobile capital intensity is coming down again next year. That's not permanent, but it's another good for free cash flow. The investment in the pension fund, not so much investment in the future there. How should investors think about the direction of capital intensity as the fiber program reaches its second half, and as these other things allow you to generate more discretionary free cash flow? How should investors think about the use of it?
I think you should a lot more of the same. We've been seeing capital intensity grow over the past seven, years or so, 15, 16, 17, 17.5%. I think we've probably reached a point now that we're at a capital efficiency sweet spot. We spend roughly around $4 billion. I don't think we could go too much faster with our fiber product efficiently. That 700,000 to 800,000 seems to be a sweet spot for rollout, for bringing broadband to households. So I see capital intensity probably starting to decline, not because we're reducing spending, it's because revenues are growing, and that $4 billion mark seems to be about the right place for our capital spending on an absolute basis. So I think from a free cash flow perspective, if you don't have the pension burden and you certainly don't have the M&A in front of you that we had in the past, you continue a healthy, vibrant investment back in the network in that roughly 16 to 17% intensity mark, then you'll see that free cash flow unto itself probably has an opportunity to grow. I think I would be a bit overzealous to get too excited about the material decline in CI, because I don't think that happens until post-fiber. And as I said, it's probably 5 to 7 years out, but one day when you're done investing what amounts to $2 billion a year in fiber, do I think there's a step function change in that $4 billion spent? Absolutely. I think one day that changes materially, because we will have completed rebuilding the copper network that served us so well for 130 years with the network that will serve us for the next 130 years. But, frankly, that's probably 5 to 7 years before we can start thinking that way.
Well, then, thank you for your time today. Thank you.
Thank you, Adam, and thank you, everyone, for coming.